Welcome to Coaching Uncaged, the podcast on all things coaching, brought to you by Animas. And now introducing your host, Yannick Jacob.
All right, here we are. Hello, Dr. Kim Bradley Cole. It is such a pleasure to have you on the podcast. Welcome.
Thank you.
I'm excited about today, not just because I'm taking the baton from the mighty Robert Stevenson, but also because I've been digging into your book. Social Constructivism is an approach that's always resonated with me in many ways. I know Nick is a bit obsessed with it. In the context of transformational coaching, there's so much potential in there. And I love the depth and the rigor that has gone into what you write and into your work in general. And I think it's just so valuable to coaches who try to understand change and how people operate in the world, how the mind works. And it is a revelation in terms of how you view people and their development and their growth for many people. I think for me, it resonated a lot from the very beginning. But for other people, it seems incredible how we can offer a different perspective on how people change and grow. And so that's why I think it's so relevant for coaches to be listening to this. And I thank you so much for the work that you've been put in. Your book is comprehensive, even as a guide to how to coach in general. There's so much in there that is very useful. So I'm happy to open up that space, get to know you a little bit more, maybe hear some stories from your coaching, and see how the constructivist approach can benefit the coaches out there.
Yeah, that's brilliant. Thank you.
So maybe you could start by telling us a little bit of your story. How did you get into the approach? What resonated with you, and how did you arrive at that in the context of coaching?
Okay, so my journey is, like most people's journeys, quite winding and quite long in life. So I started, my first career was in marketing, and I worked for quite a number of large FMCG companies, leading their development of their brands. I worked in sort of in market development and innovations more, so taking brands into new spaces. And then in 2005, I had an epiphany and decided that we were doing so much insight work in my role in innovations. And we were embedding ourselves in people's lives to try and understand how. So rather than just doing focus groups and doing the sort of standard qualitative approach in market research terms, we really did think that actually we wanted to ethnographically understand how people live and how we, from a brand perspective, could make our brands more salient to people and how we could evolve them and adapt them.
Yeah, when you say ethnographically, could you just
immerse yourself in people's lives. So not to so rather than just ask them direct questions, and this is one of the things that really opened my mind to the different ways of understanding the world, is that if you ask somebody a direct question, which do you prefer, what do you think of this, what do you think of that, what's your views on, which is sort of standard questionnaire design. Mm-hmm. You will get back from them their learned social scripts. And because people, we basically live our lives largely through doing. We don't spend a lot of our lives reflecting on why we think or believe in the way that we do. But actually, even the very person that we have grown to become is largely something that is given to us by others. So the roles that we take on in life are things that we've maybe had small feedback on, because we all have an innate desire to belong. We want to find our place in the group. If somebody tells you that you're good at something and that person is someone in authority, then you might run with that. So if you're told at a young age that you are sporty or that you are artistic, then you might just find yourself running down that path and reinforcing those beliels.
So you get constructed.
Yeah. So you get to adulthood with all these sets of myths and scripts that you've been given about who you are as a person, and you've never thought about them. You just accept them and go with it. But obviously, if you've accommodated things in not a particularly constructive or helpful way, then you can have quite a few damaged scripts going on for you. So anyway, I've sort of gone off the point really, which I often do. So that was really where I started, was actually with a desire to shift my career into insight, because I just found it fascinating. I find people's lives really fascinating, and I love being with people. I love love talking to people. And also, because I was working in innovations, I was working at running lots of project teams, and in innovations, you're trying, basically in food innovation, you're trying to come up with groundbreaking ideas on really old factory kit, or in with suppliers that are contract suppliers. So there's an awful lot of negotiation and bringing people with you and changing mindsets. And I just became quite fascinated that you can bring together a project team, and everyone's got their own agendas and their own ideas, and nobody really wants you to disrupt their space. And that's your job, is to disrupt space. And you're up against real tight timelines to get these things developed and out. And so you bring a project team together, and they're disparate people, and they're really not committed, and they don't really want to upset the apple cart. And then by the time you're about to launch your product, you've got the whole team, it's their baby. They've bought into it. So that psychological change for people started to become really interested in, and how we relate to each other and what's meaningful to us in our lives and in our work, and how you can radically shift people's perspectives about themselves and about their roles in quite short spaces of time. So that was my epiphany. I thought, and when I came across this course at Royal Holloway, where I could convert my degree to a psychology degree by going and studying, so it's a conversion, postgraduate conversion diploma. So I thought, I want to do that. I'm going to go and do that for a year. So I went off to Royal Holloway, and from the day I landed on that course, I felt like I've come home. This is amazing what I'm learning.
What was the course called?
So it's postgraduate diploma in psychology. So basically, to be a psychologist, you have to have the graduate basis for chartership from the BPS, which you get if you do an accredited psychology degree.
Right.
You can't just call yourself, you can't study any psychology course and call yourself a psychologist. You can't even study an undergraduate degree and call yourself a psychologist.
Yeah.
But in order to become a psychologist, you have to have this thing called graduate basis for chartership in order to go on to an accredited master's program. I just went because I wanted a year of doing something differently, and a year of me, really.
So it's really interesting just to kind of recap your journey. So you started with trying to figure out why people make decisions buy products beyond the scripts and constructs, and really try to figure out what the person really wants and how they make decisions beyond those scripts. And then you started working with teams and how they start working together and really adopt a new sort of script.
Yeah.
And that led you into psychology. So all of this psychology work that you've been doing was before you actually studied any of it.
Yes. Yes. I mean, obviously I started coaching and mentoring. A lot of my job was, I led a team, I recruited graduates. So my whole sort of corporate career was around mentoring and bringing people with me. I got a lot of personal satisfaction from that. Then after I'd done my Royal Holloway course, I went and did a master's in occupational psychology, because I thought that would blend my corporate experience with my new discovery of the world of psychology. And I knew quite quickly that I was really situated within social psychology. That was what I really want and love, understanding how people operate within their social context. And I'm less interested in sticking things on their heads to see what's happening in their brains. I'm interested in the whole person, and that sort of comes to explain why constructivism opened a door for me.
Mm-hmm.
So then after I'd done my master's, I went and back into the world of work, and I worked as a freelance consultant, occupational psychologist, and as a HR practitioner for a large corporate. And I ran a transformational change program for, well, it's a people change program for that organization.
Mm-hmm.
And then felt that my learning journey wasn't over. I got my chartership, became an occupational psychologist proper, and thought my journey wasn't over. And so went back to Reading University and did my PhD in leadership and organizational behavior. Because when I was doing my conversion diploma, that was the first time that the work of Kelly was introduced to me
mm-hmm.
through the repertory grid. And I think we were, all of our group on that small course were like, wow, that has such powerful application to the world of work as a way of deconstructing how people think.
Yeah.
And so when I came to do my PhD, I used Kelly's work to do my research for my mm-hmm. PhD, which was, are you going to say something?
No. I was just, I think it's a really good time to dig into the work of George Kelly a little bit, because it is the foundation of a lot of what you've developed in the coaching space.
Yes,
and it would be a really good foundation to draw it out a little bit, the social constructionism also versus personal constructivism. And you mentioned ontology and epistemology, which are terms that usually have a strong reaction with a lot of people, because that's where we get really academic, when really it's important to understand what is the foundation of what we're applying here. It's about how do we know things?
Yeah.
What is the nature of being? So if you could, I love the nod as an existentialist to the phenomenologists, even after all these years, Husserl and Heidegger, for example. So if you could talk a little bit in the most tangible way as possible to draw out the foundation of where this is coming from and why it's important that we're clear on what the foundation is.
Yes, I mean, I think people do get quite nervous or worried about these terms, ontology and epistemology, where they're actually quite simple. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just with some academics, they like to use large words, which are not helpful to people in sort of general life. And so ontology really just means what do you believe the nature of the world is? So a positivist, as in somebody who is an empiricist ideal, so they believe that there is one fixed world out there. We live in one fixed world that we can see, we can touch, we can understand, and my experience of that world will be exactly the same as your experience of that world, because mm-hmm. that world exists in its own right as a static or real thing.
There's an answer and we can find it.
And so that is the basis of a lot of psychology and a lot of empirical positivist science. So in that route, if you believe that there is one concrete world out there that we can all understand, then you take a sort of fragmentalist view of science, and you believe that knowledge can be created by just layering on a little bit of knowledge onto this static thing.
Yeah, and that's just. It's the same with coaching as well. If you coach somebody from a positivistic perspective, then you believe there is one way in which this person can achieve their goal. Yes. And you can know that, and they can know that, and we can find it, or I can show them the way.
Yes, and that you can see what's out there. So mm-hmm. that in a coaching relationship, your coachee has everything. They know everything. They're conscious of everything. So the basis of the GROW model and other behavioral models, and the basis of psychometrics in coaching, adopt that view that the truth is out there, and that that truth can be readily seen, and it just has to be pointed out to people.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, from a positivist, this idea of fragmentalist nature of science, that is the basis of psychometric tests. So they believe, they take a nomothetic view, which basically means we are fundamentally all the same. And the differences between us are based on what aspects, how much or less of each individual trait each of us has. Mm-hmm. So from a nomothetic point of view with personality theory, then we all, so if you take the sort of big five, sort of NEO or HPI view of the world, we all share common traits. And the differences between us come from differences between those traits. Mm-hmm. So as a coach, you will, it's very much a test and tell approach. You will go in, you will give a person a personality test of some sort, and then you will tell them the sort of person that they are or what their preferences are. They talk about preferences, mm-hmm. but we mustn't forget that from a positivist view of science and from the big five personality view, what they are saying to you is that your personality from the age of 25 is reasonably stable, that mm-hmm. you stay the same person pretty mm-hmm. much throughout your life. I mean, that is a bit of an oversimplification, because recent researchers are now saying, they are now acknowledging that personality evolves. But they are really saying that those core essences of yourself are stable and static. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Costa and McRae have been very clear in that their belief is that from mid-20s, that's pretty much you on your path of life.
Yeah, and if you strongly believe that, then the chances are much more that it's going to be true for you.
Yeah,
because, you know, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah, so the issue I have with that, and I think that's something I've come into, is that I have a big issue with putting people in boxes. I think mm-hmm. if you put people in boxes, you lose the beauty of the person. Mm-hmm. And we are all of us, so for me, even translates to things around diversity and inclusion. For me, inclusion is around making sure that every single individual feels that they're heard, that they have a voice, that they feel safe to express what's important and meaningful to them. It's not about quotas of certain types of people for me, mm-hmm. because I think we're all different. We all come to the world and we all come to our experience and our current points with a whole different set of understanding about ourselves and the world we live in. Mm-hmm. To really help people transform, you need to acknowledge that. So so as I said, ontology is about understanding, you know, what do we believe the nature of reality is? What do we believe about the world in which we live? So if you take a positivist view, then you're saying that there is one fixed reality out there. We can all see the world. We all live in the same world. From a constructivist perspective, it takes a more relativist position in that it says, and certainly for personal constructivism, it's sort of like that. So extreme relativism will say that there is no single reality out there at all, that reality is an illusion and fluid.
Yeah, you mentioned Einstein in your book at some point, that it matters how you look at things. The observer matters, and no two people can view the same reality just because they don't have the same point of perspective.
Exactly. But most constructivism sits in this sort of weaker relativist position, which says that we're not actually even going to debate whether there's a single reality out there, because our knowledge and experience of reality is only relative to our interpretation of it, and that you can't know reality in its, you can't see it in its entirety. So everything has a purpose, everything has a meaning to us, everything is symbolic. And actually what matters is how we interpret our world, our lived world, our experiences within that world. So really, though, you've got those two different positions of what reality is, and constructivism sits in more in this relativist space. And then epistemology is just really saying, depending on which nature of reality you accept, how do we study that? How do we study the world, and how do we come to know? So we've already talked about how personality theory enables us to explore the world from a sort of fixed ontological view. So there is a single truth that we can find. And by breaking, and from that perspective, it's around breaking down the person into their constituent parts and working with those constituent parts. So let's see how extrovert you are and see if we can help you build your extroversion or the facets that sit beneath that. And we are, whereas constructivism, sitting in the relativist thing side, says, no, you have to work with the whole person. The whole person exists in their lived world. So you can't divorce the person from their context. Personal constructivism is very much about the whole person is created through their experiences, and therefore you need to understand the nature of experiences, because everything that we do is interpretive and anticipatory, and we are trying to give ourselves a sense of order in a chaotic world. So let's work with that person and understand the person situated within their life world. And those are really the two differences. And the sort of, I guess, the we're very much drawn to the positivist view of science, because that's the way that the natural sciences work. That's the way we've been enculturated to believe that that is science.
There's a comfort in believing that there's an answer or one truth that we can explore and find out. Complexity is scary.
Yes, and we seek certainty. We seek certainty in an uncertain world. And our lives are precarious, but we don't want to feel that they're precarious. So that's it helps us feel safe to go into that space. But from a coaching situation, it's not, I don't believe it's particularly helpful to us, because we're also drawn to it's sort of like horoscopes. So we want people to tell us who we are rather than trying to work out who we are ourselves.
Wouldn't that be nice?
So personality theory does that. And then also in an organisational setting, we've come into this sort of narrative and discourse around simplicity. So if you think about how people generally work in organisations, we are encouraged to strip things down to to their fundamental parts. So that fits with a positivist view. We also, through social media and the way that we consume knowledge now, we take it in small bites. So again, that sort of sits into that side of science. But my view is that if somebody's telling you who you are in a coaching situation, that's not transformative. That might feel comfortable. It might feel, safe, might feel reassuring.
Somebody else is doing the work for you. And some people really like that until they don't like it anymore because they're being defined by others.
Exactly. And you're not, it's not going to change your future. It's not going to empower you to take yourself down a new path. And so for me, for somebody who did go down a new path in their sort of midlife, and see that actually it just opens up a whole new world and a whole new different way of seeing the world in quite revolutionary terms, which can be quite unsettling. And I have become much more of an advocate of what's the utility, because the utility of a sort of behavioural coaching is all right if your problem is functional. It works if you've got a functional issue that you need to solve that you're fully aware of. But we don't, as I said earlier, we don't reflect on our lives. We don't reflect on our journeys. If you take a view, so in constructivism, when you're working with the whole person, you take the view that personality is not fixed. Personality evolves over the lifespan, and it's something that's dynamic that you craft, you create. And therefore, you're in control of who you are and what you choose to do with your life. And that's a much more sort of meaningful way. So you mentioned about positive psychology earlier on, and that is about the journey to a meaningful life.
Yeah, and it's empowering, because all of a sudden we are in a position where we can reconstruct ourselves through a personal construct. But that's also scary, because now we need to take responsibility. A lot of people, a lot of coaching clients, I think they seek positivist coaches because the coach does a lot of the work by telling them who they are and how to live their life. And I think it can change people's future, but maybe not in the way that we would want, because then coaching clients find themselves in this changed future that is constructed by somebody else. And it often feels inauthentic, and that creeps in, and it's not always obvious. And then they find themselves in a position where, you know, they're a different person, but they don't feel like they've had any say in it.
Exactly. And this notion of authenticity is really important, because it's living the life that you choose and being the person that you want to be. And mm-hmm. if you go down the sort of positivist view, you're still living the life that you believe is socially appropriate. So it's the, you know, you may be conformed to ideas if you're in an organizational setting of what makes a great leader, and you want to improve your leadership skills, without really understanding that from all the research I've done around leadership and around authenticity at work, the fundamental things that matter to people at work is to feel that they are working with people who care about them, and that they have strong personal connections with the people at work. So it's sort of feeling like you're amongst friends, and people who feel most fulfilled at work feel that they are amongst friends.
Right.
So they're not conforming to any form of, oh, a leader has to be this type of person.
Yeah.
And until you release yourself from that, from those shackles. So that's one of the metaphors we use in the book, is around changing, you know, moving out of a prison, the prison that all these rules and scripts have created for you, and releasing yourself and starting to see and create your own home. So moving from a prison setting into a home setting. And how would you, your home is an expression of you. What's that expression of you that you want to show the world? Because in a prison, you're living by other people's rules. It might feel safe because you're in an institution, and therefore you don't have to think about how you look after yourself, because everyone's telling you, you're being told every day what to do and how to do things and where to go and what time you do this, that and the other. But when you move into your home, that's your space. That's your space from which you go out into the world. And it's, and you are free to express yourself.
And you're responsible for it.
Yep, absolutely. And in any way that you want, in order that makes you feel that you, that that's you. So that really is around, and this is what the power of constructivist thought is, the ability for you to identify the parts of yourself that really matter, that you want to keep, and the parts of yourself that somebody else has given you through your enculturation and your parenting and your schooling and all those other things. And what things of those aspects do you really feel that actually are dragging you down, or shackling you, or holding you back?
And what a fascinating journey that is, to start digging those things up and exploring these. And some of them are conscious, some of them are unconscious, as you say. So this journey, this exploration of revealing how I've been constructing myself, how other people, the world around me has helped to construct myself, to get to the point where I feel I can make those decisions and reconstruct this, make some different decisions, figuring out what are my decisions, what's the life that I live for others. I can't help but think that this could be quite a therapeutic journey, but it could also be very much a coaching journey. So could you talk a little bit into that gray area, or what makes it coaching, and at what point does it become therapy?
So it's coaching because you're dealing with functioning people. The normal people who are living their normal lives quite well, quite happily. There might be things that they feel that they're not doing quite as well as they could, or they might be having some relational issues. That, you know, I mean, obviously I'm an occupational psychologist, so most of the work that I do is either in the career space or around workspace or leadership or things. So they might feel that they've got some interpersonal issues going on with, or they're not very good, you know, they're having struggles with influencing other people, or they're not finding their work fulfilling, those things. So they're aware of something's not right, but there is no clinical issue. Mm-hmm. So it's coaching because you're taking a normally functioning person and you're trying to improve their functioning. as opposed to taking somebody who is subnormally functioning and trying to get them back into a normalized space, which would be therapy. What you have to recognize, though, if you, so there's two ways that you can be a constructivist coach, and certainly that's what we're trying to get forward in the book, is that you can buy into the philosophy and you can recognize the limitations of behavioral coaching, and you can say, actually, I want to work in a coaching space that is more transformative, that works with my coachees as individuals, that understands their life stories and helps them move forward. Or you can say, actually, I just want to have more flexible ways of working with my clients. So I'm interested in using the methods that constructivist approaches give me, but I don't want to buy into the philosophy. Mm-hmm. So really, you need to sort of work out where you sit first, really, and then move forward from that. And now I've lost my train of thought.
Well, I would pick you up on the methods, because I think it's pretty clear why this is coaching and why this isn't therapy. And that, was that the train of thought there?
Yeah, no, that's what I was going to say. I was saying, right, you must be aware, if you're a coach working in this space, because you will be, because you'll be working with people's sort of pre-verbal emotional responses to things, you can very, and people, different people will react differently to the surfacing of things that they hadn't thought about. Mm-hmm. So you can get very quickly to clinical boundaries. Mm-hmm. And so you must be at all times very aware of those clinical boundaries, mm-hmm, and aware of the space that you are qualified to work within. Mm-hmm.
Could you give us an example on that? What started as a coaching engagement and then you hit one of those boundaries because something was revealed and there was a reaction?
So I do quite a lot of coaching with women and with women at work. The women I've worked with, a lot of them, they take on expectations in their social roles, and they carry quite a lot of burden and additional responsibilities, particularly around caring and trying to be perfect at work and perfect at home and things like that. So I would say, and this isn't exclusively to women, because I've had this with male clients as well, but I think the realization that I didn't realize I felt that way. It's, you know, people can get quite upset and they can burst into tears. They can get quite angry with themselves, especially if they're living to this perfect script. The internalization of, I'm failing because I've got these things I hadn't thought about, and I should have thought about them. So it's really important as a coach in this space to be comfortable with silence, to allow the person the space to get upset, to take a break, to walk out. I mean, I've had people walk out of the room because they've been so upset. I do have to say that this is not like a common experience of everything. Generally, people who go through this process find it really enlightening and really empowering and life-affirming. Even the ones that do burst into tears do get quite upset, particularly when they realize that they have been coerced or manipulated by other people, where their previous pivotal relationships have damaged them in some way that they had just shut out or not recognized. Mm-hmm. Or they feel that they've lost opportunities, particularly coming back to the sort of perfect script, but they haven't explored every opportunity so far. So again, you need to be comfortable with silence. You need to recognize when the conversation has gone far enough for that day and give that person space. You need to not leave a person in pain. You mustn't ever do any harm. So if a person does get upset, you're going to have to work with them until they're okay okay to leave the session. So don't back up your sessions, because if someone gets upset, you might go over your time allocation.
So there's a potential because of the material that you're working with, and that new insights can go quite deep. And even a fully functioning person, very resourceful, can come to a point where they get really upset and they have to grapple with that for a bit. And maybe you need to stay with them a little bit longer than the assigned time for the session just to make sure they're okay. And then can integrate the new insights into a new construct.
Yes. So, I mean, we give you lots of examples in the book, lots of techniques in the book to work through with people so you're not leaving people, and to understand the sense-making cycle and to move through that creativity space, which is about, and to just even just to say things like, this is a normal part of the process, that, you know, obviously things get surfaced, and if you haven't thought about them, it can be unsettling. So don't worry, take your time. It's fine. It's absolutely fine.
Yeah. So what would that kind of process be? There's a couple of models in the book, but like there's a process in the constructivist approach of how you guide somebody through that sort of journey. Could you outline that briefly? So coaches out there get a sense for how that could look like.
Okay, so it's not a standard. So I think, again, this is embracing the idea that each coaching journey that you have will be different. Mm-hmm. So you have a sort of a guide that you can follow, but you don't, it's not rigid. So you can't have a coaching session where you know, let's like look at your goals, let's look at reality, let's look at the opportunity. You can't do that. But what we have done is develop a sense-making cycle for coaches to work through, which is based on the work of Kelly. And obviously Kelly's work comes in two very, very thick volumes.
Yeah, very dense, very difficult to read.
Exactly. And generally people spend more time focusing on the first volume, which is his complete stated theory of personality, which is what we touched on earlier, and how you can understand the whole person from this approach. But his volume two is much more about how he used personal constructivism in a therapeutic session, a setting. And so what we've done is translate that into coaching. So what can you take? And so he had cycles where he talked about how people make decisions, etc. And we've really turned that into this sense-making cycle. So basically you start by working with people's, so he talked about constructs, and a construct is basically just a schema of how you think about the world, and it's not the world in title, but how you a construct is something that you hold in relation to something else. That can be an aspect of a person, an object, an event, anything that helps you understand that. And it's part of our associative map that we hold in our minds. So everything's sort of mental models and schemas. And what Kelly said is that we hold these schemas as sort of as bipolar contrasts. So, and that's really how we make sense of the world that we live in. So we will look at something and we will say, that is tall and it's not short. That is fast, so it's not slow. And that's really how we understand ourselves. And if you think about this in practical terms, and you think about what I said earlier about you could believe that you are sporty or you're creative by a small thing that somebody that was important to you at an early age says to you, and then you run with that. Mm-hmm. So even things like, how do I understand? So I consider myself to be quite a creative person. How do I understand my creativity? And it is always in relation to something or someone else. You can't understand creative. And this is really why positivism has its limitations in a coaching setting, because you can't understand what anything means without context. Mm-hmm. So in order for me to say that I'm a creative person, I need to look at what's not creative and what do I see in other people that is creative or not creative. Right. And equally, my not creative. So if you asked me what's the opposite of creative, I might say boring, whereas somebody else might say stable. Mm-hmm. So again, that you start to see just through language and the symbolism of language that the meaning that we take from the most, the smallest pieces of understanding that we have is an individual thing.
Yeah.
So basically you start off in a sense making start a cycle, you start off with those beliefs, and we give you lots of tools and techniques to start surfacing people's beliefs. And this,
could you give us a few examples of what techniques, because there's a lot of really good stuff in there. Yeah. I wonder what your most frequently used are.
Okay, so we have to then go back and talk about this whole notion of metaphors. So and why, in fact, actually, I'm going to go back one more step, because you mentioned earlier right at the start of the interview that this was social constructionism, and this is not social constructionism. This is personal constructivism. Mm-hmm. And again, actually, what the next book that we're going to write is around trying to demystify these terms, because they're not understood. And so social constructionism came from sociology. So its start point is how society works. And it looks at cultural artifacts, you know, all those meaning blocks that we have in society that we use to interpret who we are and how our world is constructed. But it's very much interested in sort of our membership of groups and how we affiliate ourselves in order to craft society and you know, who we are within that. Whereas personal and then social constructivism sits in that, how do we take meaning as individuals from all that sort of social artifact? So that sort of sits in the middle. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then personal constructivism is around ourselves as individual sense makers. And that's why it's really valuable to coaching. So it's looking at how we make sense of our experiences within our embedded life world. So it starts from the person and comes up to the groups we belong to, the certain society that we live in, and looks at how we've been enculturated and stuff. But so it doesn't divorce the person from their social context. It's absolutely embedded in it, but it starts from an individual sense-making perspective. Whereas social constructionism starts from society and how do individuals take their sense of self and their sense of meaning within that overall construction of society. So they start at opposite ends. And then again, I've lost where we started.
I'm interested in the practical methods of bringing some of these up.
Okay, so then we come back down to this idea of metaphors. So in personal constructivism and in social constructionism, in the whole constructivist space, because all these things sit in this constructivist landscape, and everything is symbolic. Language is symbolic, objects are symbolic. And so metaphors are really key to understanding how we make sense of our lived worlds. Mm-hmm. And Kelly came up with this. His original idea was that people are scientists, that they go about the world and making sense of things through anticipation and trying to work out their little rules. Mm-hmm. And that they into their construct system is the whole mental model of their brain and how they hold knowledge, and it's the whole thing. But you can never know a person's entire construct system. So in a coaching setting, you're looking, and in a research setting as well, but you're looking to explore relevant parts of that construct system. And that's all you can know is that point in time, that little part. Later constructivists, personal constructivists who built on Kelly's work, came up with this metaphor of person as storyteller, and this idea that we live narrated lives, so we tell ourselves what our life is as we travel along our journey. Mm-hmm. And that's particularly valuable for coaching, because if you understand the narrative thread of a person's life, then you can help them change their story.
So you're being extra sensitive to language and the narrative that your client presents themselves with, and mirror that back or feed that back so you can explore it together.
Yes. So rather than being, so in a positivist view of coaching, you're the person as the coach, you're the person who's administering the test, you're the person who's telling the person what the results of their test are, so you're telling them what their preferences are, etc. And so you're very much in the role of expert. Mm-hmm. In a constructivist coaching relationship, you are a co-explorer. You're joining that coachee on their journey of their life, on the road that they want to explore, and you are there as a critical friend. You are not there to tell them where they should turn. You're there to help them understand the beauty of the landscape around them, mm-hmm. and help them get to the top of the hill and see the whole vista. And that's mm-hmm. your job. But they are in control of their journey. Mm-hmm. So again, we've given you quite a lot of tools to think about how you best do that. And they can all be used flexibly at different stages in the coaching process. We give you two metaphors. We give you the theatre of life as a way of understanding people's social roles, which is quite important. And then I've forgotten the other one.
How does it work, the theatre of life?
So the theatre of life works in that, again, it comes down to this idea that we are given roles that, you know, we don't choose our roles. Our roles in life are largely given to us. Even by the nature of the sex that we're born into, there are you know, gendered expectations of how people behave and you know, the family that we're born into, the culture that we're born into, all those things give you this idea of what your role should be.
As in a theatre, the director would assign you, you're going to play Hamlet, and then you embody that role.
In the theatre of life, what we would do, so we have a picture, and it's a picture that's at the back of the book. I know what the other one is, and I've talked about it already. It's the prison versus home metaphor. So in the theatre of life, we have a picture that you can use, but you can use any visual of an internal theatre. You don't have to use my particular drawing of an internal theatre. Mm-hmm. And we ask the coachee to tell us, so in the theatre of your life, where would you seat yourself? Where would you site yourself in this drawing? So would you put yourself on the stage? Would you put yourself in the stalls, in the music, the drum bit? Would you put yourself in the Royal Circle? Would you put yourself in the wings, in the toilet? There's lots of different ways. Are you not in the theatre at all? And who else is on the stage with you? So that's a really valuable way to help the coachee explore their role and where their role sits. And then you move on and you ask them, where would you like your role to be? What would your next role be? Mm-hmm. And then so they're saying, well, I'm in the wings. Because you can explore with them, well, what's the play? What's the play that's mm-hmm. being played? And then you get really rich, valuable language around. So is the play a comedy? Is it a horror? Is it a drama? Is it, you know, what is it? What is going on for you there? And in the nature of the play they choose, do they make up a play or do they choose a play that is a famous play? Mm-hmm. And so, that, you know, very, very quickly, just by that one metaphor, you can get into a really rich conversational.
Yes, there's so many arms to it.
Yeah. And then but you have to listen. You have to listen. You have to hear the words they're using. You have to hear the metaphors that they themselves use.
Yeah.
And you have to also hear the things they're not saying. So again, let's explore the role you have in the context of the roles of other people around you. You very quickly get to an idea of who are their important others. Mm-hmm. And you can do that in a home setting, you can do it in a work setting, you just let them, because it's their story. So you don't tell them what they should give you, you don't police that in any way. You just see what comes out and you work with what comes out. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot of, we call it laddering, which is a lot of up and down questioning. So you can really, and this is helping them explore the sort of non-verbal, the emotional aspects of their life. So if they hold something, you know, construct in their head or a belief in their head, but they don't really know where that belief came from or what that was about, And that's quite difficult then for them to change it, because is it just a universal truth? So you can try to help them get closer to those core beliefs by asking them just the simple question of why is that important? Mm-hmm. What does that offer you? Mm-hmm. And then if you want to help them think about all the different contexts in which that belief is playing out for them, then you just say, could you give me an example of where that belief mattered to you? Mm-hmm. And can you give me another example? Mm-hmm. So the trick about being a good constructivist coach is listening and being comfortable with silence, as well as knowing your clinical boundaries. But you have to go with what the person is telling you. You have to be credulous in that context in order to understand. So a credulous approach is really about accepting that whatever that person says, however ludicrous it might appear to you in your worldview, mm-hmm. it's a truth for them. So you need to go with that truth and not censor it in any way. And just unpack it and work with it and try and understand it. And if they then get to a point where they feel that actually, no, they want to reframe it, then you're moving around the sense-making cycle, because you've worked with their beliefs. You can move around to the next stage, which is to let's explore some different ways of constructing that belief.
Yeah.
Then either through role play or by helping them go out into the world to experiment with new, more productive ways of thinking, they can go out and they can have a go.
Yeah.
So this is something that is really, and then they come back and they reflect on it and they go around the cycle again. They keep going around that cycle as long as it takes, really. And some people go around the cycle once and they go around it in a complex, deep way. And some people go around it multiple times, depending on their journey of enlightenment, really. And what I found that particularly useful, I mean, I think in the book we show that this approach has applications and relevance to pretty much any coaching context you can think of. And you know, I'll give an example of a person I worked with, just even from a business development perspective, as to how can I determine how to make my business resonate with my potential customers? What do I want my business to be? And how can I be true to the values I want to set up for my business? So even just thinking through those things that seem quite cold and clinical, this approach has value, as well as, you know, things I'm having issues at work. My manager is very difficult. I mean, I've worked with people who are totally distraught because they feel they've got to leave yet another job because they just can't get on with the people there. And I don't see how a psychometric approach is going to help them solve that problem and solve them. They're sort of, what is it that's happening to them in their lived existence that is derailing them? And what can they do mm-hmm. to change that, change their outcomes?
But isn't a personality type assessment just another way of shining light on the construct of themselves through the lens of personality?
Well, it's not a light that they've turned on. So I guess really.
But they've answered the questions.
They've answered the questions. They don't recognize. I mean, I've worked with, because obviously I'm a registered test user. Mm-hmm. I don't use them anymore, to be fair, because I have failed to find them truly valuable. So they do. They have. I'm not saying that. I'm not dismissing them entirely. They have value in simpler settings, but I don't subscribe to the philosophy. So therefore it wouldn't be authentic of me to use them, because I don't subscribe to the idea that we are best understood by breaking us down into our constituent parts. And I don't subscribe to the idea that there is one fixed reality out there that's stable, that we can all understand. I think we're complex beings,
Very much so. And quite malleable. So I think it's very much depends on how we use any form of assessment or any form of structured approach to create some more awareness. Because if we take that to the starting point of a conversation and then we're being curious about what do you make of this? You know, what surprised you? What resonates? What doesn't resonate? I mean, any set of questions is merely a snapshot of how you've answered them at this particular time. And if you take that as a starting point, I can see that as a starting point to a constructivist conversation as well.
Yeah. But I mean, I've spoken to so many people that when you say to them, honestly, I've spoken to many, many people who say that a personality test has enlightened them as to who they are. And when you say to them, but you answered the questions. So the personality test is just telling you back what you've answered. A lot of them don't make that connection.
Oh, so they take the empowerment out of it and they give the credit to the algorithm or the coach or the assessor rather than to themselves.
Yeah. And I think that it comes back to what I said earlier on about how we are taught to seek simplicity. Mm-hmm. We are also taught things about, you know, what makes a good leader. And the person who's a good leader, we're told, is somebody who's decisive, who's quick thinking, who can cut through all the complexity. So everything in our lives, particularly in Western society, it is driving us down that nomothetic route and that simplistic route. And I think, yes, it can help you. It can help you if you have a functional problem, but it doesn't really help you transform in a liberating and empowering way, because you're not in the driving seat. You're not, in a constructivist sense, as I said, you're a critical friend, you're a co-voyager. You're joining them on their journey of exploration and discovery. Mm-hmm. And it's their journey. And that journey of exploration is not contained by anybody else's view of how the world should be, just theirs.
Yeah, that makes sense. So to what extent are these personal constructs malleable? What are the limits of change and transformation from this perspective?
So again, that depends upon the level at which the construct is held and whether it's more peripheral or more core. Mm-hmm. So we know just generally from attitude theory that most attitudes are weakly held and most attitudes are not reflective or reflected on at all. And therefore, we're really open to change at that level. And that's sort of the basis of marketing, really, that most of our thoughts and most of our decisions are habitually made. And therefore we're also a lot more susceptible to social influence and to persuasion than we like to think we are. Mm-hmm. And I think you can see how social contagion takes off on social media.
Example, masks and vaccines, they seem to be peripherally held, but then they seem to be so rigid as well.
Yes, exactly. So, but we have an innate drive to belong. We want to feel that we have a purpose, that we're a purposeful person, that we have our place in the group, with group animals. So we want to know who we are, why we're here, what we're doing. Mm-hmm. But you just see it. So people drop a narrative in and you see it spread so quickly. So right now, one of the narratives I've been hearing this week is, in terms of the pandemic, well, we just need to get on with it. And so many people are saying that. And that's come from media and media messaging. So, but actually, we don't know. We don't know, because there is another variant in France. This idea of let's not listen to experts. Yeah. Where did that come
Isn't
from?
It then tempting, at least sometimes, when you're the coach and you see an opportunity to influence someone for the better by introducing a narrative like this, rather than, you know, waiting for the person to create their own better narrative?
Yep.
Because it's a powerful position that you're in when you have this overview of what's happening in front of you with this client.
That's exactly, and that's one of the nubs of the issues really in the approach, that you have to bracket everything that you think is right and true about the world. This is not your coaching process. This is not your journey. And no, you shouldn't be overlaying any. Your aim is, it's emic research. It's understanding how that person's living in their world, what's working for them, what's not working for them, from their perspective. And you're surfacing that so that you're enabling them to make decisions, their own decisions about themselves, about the person they want to be, and about their future direction. Mm-hmm. You're not telling them what's right and what's wrong, what's better and what's worse. You're not, they need to feel that they trust you. They need to have a rapport with you. So there's some sort of level of sharing. Then the need in sort of coaching to be seen as an equal. So anything that you do and how you present yourself as a coach that might make them feel that you're superior, that you're in a position of authority, you've got to be so much more conscious about. So how you dress to the match them. So all your sort of own, and again, as a constructivist coach, you need to be much more aware of your own biases and work through them, and your own constructs, and your own insecurities. So you need to be quite self-aware, and think of, and question all the time, why do I think that? Why do I want that? And how do I make sure that doesn't come through?
Smells like lots and lots of supervision.
Yes. Yeah. Well, yeah. But then again, your supervisor has to, you know, so it doesn't have to be supervision, but it does have to be lots of reflection and critical thinking and talking. I think what's more valuable in this space is a community. And obviously constructivist thinking is about communities of practice. That's how your constructivist learning is all built around communities of practice. So at least having one other friend, one other coaching friend who shares your view of the world that you can discuss things through with, so that you're always open and always flexible. I'm not too sure that I would feel uncomfortable if your supervisor had an unequal relationship with you. Yeah, because then they're the person in the position of authority.
You want to meet your client from that perspective at eye level.
Yes, and you want, if you've got somebody who you are sharing your experiences of that coaching session with to try and get another perspective on, so which would be the classic supervisor role, you've got to feel on an equal footing with that person as well. You as a coach have to do that. Because your journey as a coach is your journey. It's not anyone else's to shape.
That's amazing. I think I'm going to take that as an amazing piece of last words. Thank you so much for this conversation. The book is packed with tools and maps, systems. There's so much in there. And in your book, you thank Megan Matthew and Max Bradley Cole for turning our work into practitioner tools. Are these members of your family then?
Yeah. So these are my children. And basically what they did is they did the visuals. So they turned my hand drawings, client hand drawings, my sort of vague ideas into things that can be reproduced in the book. So the worksheets they did, the logo that they did, again, digitizing the images in the book, they did all that. So even just drawing the sense making cycle, taking my hand sketch and turning it into something that can be printed in the book. They did all that.
It's wonderful work. It really is a wellspring of practical application of the school of thought, you know, that Kelly opened and that you've so wonderfully translated into language that we can understand without being academics.
Yeah, that's so great.
Thank you so much for the work that you, your colleagues, your family have been doing. It's been amazing to talk to you. And thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for asking me.
Anything else you want to tell coaches out there?
Just really, obviously read the book. Do approach me, find me quite quickly on LinkedIn. Do approach me if you've got any other questions, or if you want any sort of physical copies of the worksheets, then, reach out to me either through my Winchester email or through LinkedIn, and let's talk. But I do think it's around just seeing the beauty in people and the beauty in life, and the real pleasure in life is through our social connections. Let's not reduce people down. Let's elaborate. Let's understand people in all their individuality and all their complexity.
Lovely words. Kim Bradley Cole, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Coaching Uncaged. If you want to find out more about becoming a coach, developing your coaching skills further, or training as a coaching supervisor, then head along to animascoaching.com. Thanks again, and catch you on the next episode.